Hello and welcome to Women with AI, a podcast focusing on the challenges and successes of women in this rapidly evolving sector. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Dr. Catherine Breslin, who is an AI consultant and machine learning scientist, with over 2 decades of experience as an AI scientist building voice and language AI models. Catherine is the founder and director of Kingfisher Labs, where she works with business leaders to bring cutting-edge technologies to market, and her previous roles include AI scientist and manager at the University of Cambridge, plus organisations such as Toshiba Research, Amazon Alexa and Cobalt Speech. She's also an AI advisor and coach and has been named one of Nesta's 12 Women Shaping AI as the expert in machine learning, and was in the 2021 list of Computer Weekly's 50 Most Influential Women in UK Tech. Catherine Breslin, welcome to Women with AI.
Thanks, Jo. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's lovely to have you here. So I'm going to start off and ask you how you got into doing what you're doing. And for those that don't know, when it comes to AI and machine learning, what is it? What's the difference? What is machine learning?
Fantastic. I'll start with maybe talking a little bit about what AI is, maybe, and what the differences. And you hear a lot of terms being thrown about right now, so maybe we can dive straight into that and start talking about those. So AI, obviously a term that's been in the media loads lately, and I think you'd have to be hiding under a rock not to have read something about the technology lately. And AI is a term that's been around a long time. It's sort of gone in and out of fashion as the technology has evolved and then lived up to its promise or not lived up to its promise. And we're going through a phase right now where AI technology is really, you know, making leaps and bounds in performance, and so people are really excited about the potential. So AI is a term which doesn't really have a, you know, a really great crisp definition, and people use it to mean a lot of different things. And so in general, maybe we can think about it as technology that is trying to sort of emulate some sort of human decision process, human decision making. So we're trying to automate things which people can do, which require a little bit more intelligence than just following a list of instructions or a list of rules. So if you've done any computer programming in the past, you'll know that what you do is you sit there and you very carefully write out a list of rules, instructions for computers to follow to do something. And so you can get quite far with that sort of technology. And you can make computers do quite a lot of things by sitting there and writing down the rules for how to do it. But there are some things that you really just can't write down the rules for. So something like understanding speech. Everyone's speech is different and everyone says different things. And so just writing down the rules about how to understand what someone is saying, you know, it's just impossible. There's so much context and variation that goes into it that it would be an impossible task to write it down. And so that's where we start to talk about machine learning. Machine learning is a subset of AI, a group of algorithms that really learn what to do from looking at data, from looking at examples. So in that example of speech recognition and understanding speech, we show the machine lots of examples of people speaking, and we also show them the words that that person said, so they can learn the patterns, learn the correlations, and understand, and you know, maybe learn a bit more about how people speak so that they can then go on to transcribe other speech. And this idea of learning from data, machine learning, and it's really what's been driving this past decade of progress in AI, I think. And then when you hear about AI, a lot of that is down to machine learning and improvements and changes in machine learning.
Okay, great, because that explains it well. Because I guess as a human, you see how someone says something, you're right, you can see the look on their face or the way they say it. So can machines learn that as well? Like, what about sarcasm?
So of course, yeah. And when you're talking to somebody, you can see a lot more. You can see, like you say, their face. You have a shared conversation history. You have some context and some cultural knowledge in there as well. And whether machines can learn all of that at the moment, I think they can't right now. I think the amount of data it would take to sort of understand all of that cultural knowledge and all of the context and nuance that goes into speech and language, we're not really at the point that computers can get all of that just yet. But we have made some strides in the past few years in being able to build these systems from bigger and bigger sets of data. And those bigger and bigger sets of data do have a lot more sort of context and nuance in them. So we're making steps in that direction. We've still got some way to go.
I guess it's like being a child, isn't it? As a young child, you're not going to get all the nuances or understand if someone isn't really meaning what they say. So I guess maybe we're at the at the beginning, although
maybe. And children are very good at understanding speech. Well,
yes. I've got two nieces and it's amazing, you know, they're 7 and 10 at the moment and it's amazing. Yeah, they definitely can pick up now. Well, they're getting better and better what it means. But so how did we get here, do you think? Because OpenAI hasn't been an overnight success, as you say, but is it that sort of that exponential, that curve? Do you think it will suddenly sort of start to move a lot quicker?
I think what has happened in the past maybe 15 years or so now is that we've seen a few things that have come together to make this technology more able to build the capability that we're seeing today. So one of the first things that's happened is that the cost of computation, the amount of computation you can do, the power, the processing capability of our computer chips has got much better in the past decade or so, which allows us to do a lot more on those chips. We also have the internet. The internet has provided a place for people to write a lot of text data, which is readable by computers. So 10, 20 years ago, we didn't have just the sheer amount of writing and audio and video on the internet as we do now. So the amount of data available to companies to build their models from has got a lot larger in the past few years. And of course, there is lots in the press right now about sort of copyright and consent of using data, but the a lot of the large companies are using quite a lot of data from the web to train their models.
Right.
And that gives us much, much larger data sets. And that's been another thing that has fed into the models being more capable. As they are learning from more and more data, they're able to sort of understand much more of the nuance and learn much more context than when you are training these models on small data sets. And I think the other thing that's happened as well is that we've had some improvements in the underlying algorithms that we use. So if you're following the field, you might have heard of sort of deep learning and transformers, diffusion models. Some of these techniques have come along more recently, and they're able to model some of the language and speech and audio better than our previous generation of models. So these three things have really come together. So amount of data, amount of computation, the internet holding it all together, and the improved algorithms. And that's really driven what we've seen in the progress in the past probably 15 years or so.
Because it is all about the data, isn't it, as you say? And I suppose it's learning from the data that's already there. So I mean, are people, how can we go about making sure that it's the right data, or is there bias in the data? And in AI voice technology, for example, are there any biases that you've come across?
Exactly. And bias is a big topic right now as well, I think, because we're starting to see that if you do train models on some of the larger data sets that we see, machine learning models, because they're learning patterns in data, they learn whatever is there. They're not, making conscious decisions about whether something is biased or not, and they should use it like humans sometimes do. They are just learning everything is equal in that data set. And as you can imagine, quite a lot of the writing, quite a lot of the speech on the internet does exhibit certain kinds of biases. And those biases then do just sort of transfer straight through into our machine learning models that we're building. And companies are putting a lot of effort into mitigating some of these biases now. But I think some of the ways that you see it play out are with especially when we're thinking about voice and language technology, we see a lot of different accents in the world. So everybody, even here in the UK, we have so many different accents, but only some of those accents are better recognized by computers than others. So we sort of see this uneven distribution of performance across different accents is one way we see this. Mm. We see this technology being developed much more for languages like English, Spanish, Mandarin, for which there is lots of data. And of course, there are something like 6,500 languages in the world, and very few of those have enough written data to be able to build the same level of model from. So we see an uneven distribution in the languages that we're covering as well. So something like English, you know, very, very much more capable technology than some of these, what we call sort of low resource languages.
Yeah.
So we see different aspects like this in voice technology. Mm. Moving on to sort of language technology as well, and people talk about the biases. If you've played with any of these language models, so ChatGPT or, you know, Claude or any of these models, they are trained on data which exhibits the views of of the internet, which is also very Western biased and exhibits a lot of sort of racial and gender biases as well. And those can carry through into the models when you start to train on them. So I think there's different ways, in these different places that some of that bias comes through to the technology.
Yeah, different challenges. And that, I suppose, leads me on to thinking, you know, I mean, I know other voices are available and you can choose the voice of your AI, but most AI voices, well, to me anyway, you know, including Alexa and Siri, are female voices. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, this is another way that I think we see some of society's bias play out in technology. So when these systems were built, probably, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, Alexa, Siri, a lot of these voice assistants were built. It was much more difficult to build a synthetic voice. It took a lot of effort to record audio from one person and convert that into a synthetic version of their voice. So it was very time intensive, very expensive to build multiple voices. So a lot of these organizations, a lot of these projects started with the idea of offering a diversity of voices to people, but realized that practically it was very difficult to build them. And so they would sort of settle on one voice. And there is a lot of evidence in the literature that people tend to prefer female voices as well. And so you see this sort of reinforcing cycle where organizations will choose voices that people prefer, which reflect the biases in society and sort of embed and entrench those. And so the cycle sort of continues. Now, I think we're in a situation where companies, synthetic voices, it's much easier to make them in a variety of voices. And companies are starting now to offer a lot more variety in the voice that they do. But some of this, you know, people still associate voice assistants with female voices.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I mean, it could be, I mean, I've done a bit of reading around the subject. And is it because female voices are maybe less threatening or because it's sometimes it's easier to sort of have, I don't know, a female in the role of assistant? I mean, I don't know, they're the biases that you don't want to sort of encourage, do you? But was it someone, a friend said to me the other day, is it due to Star Trek? Is it because Star Trek, when they had the computer, it was a female voice and it's just, it's sort of all started from there? Or then you look onto sort of films and TV and, but generally robots tend to look female, but is that because they're being designed by males, or are they being designed by females, or is it because they're just less scary than a you know, a Terminator, like the male version of the robot? I'm not sure, like, how do we make them gender neutral, or should we?
Yes, an interesting question. People have tried. I have seen sort of a gender neutral voice that people have developed, but one of the things that, even no matter how neutral you try and make a voice, you know, people, I still found myself making assumptions about the person behind that voice. Yeah. So every voice, there is really no sort of neutral voice. Every voice has some sort of cultural or, you know, associations with it that, and therefore, so I think my view is that we want to offer variety rather than, you know, try and build a neutral voice, because there is no such thing as a neutral voice. Like, there's no such thing as a neutral accent, although a lot of people feel like, I don't have an accent.
I would say I don't have an accent. That. But it depends where you are. But I found as well,
it depends where you
My Alexa, I hope she's not listening, she might start speaking, but I have it slightly speeded up. And I know that's something that when other people come around to my house and they ask something, and they're like, what's wrong with her? And I said, I just had it speeded up quickly. You know, if I need to know what the weather's like in the morning, I haven't got time. I need to know straight away. Or tell it to me quickly. And I've tried different, you know, having the different voices, but I quite liked it, you know, playing with it when I had Siri to begin with. And I was like, I quite like watching Neighbours. Maybe I'll have the Australian voice. And I found that I preferred the Australian woman to the Australian man, because it was easier to understand. But I've gone back to the British version now. But talking about bias and women in industry, I know that you're keen to get more women and girls interested in STEM, and you co-founded the Cambridge branch of the British Science Association and RoboGals. So can you tell our audience a little bit about that, please, and how we can get more girls interested in STEM?
I mean, we do have, there's a big gender problem in technology, and maybe the same applies for racial bias and other sort of minorities as well. But there are really a lot of statistics out there that show us that women are not choosing to work in technology. And if they are, they're not sort of rising up the ladder and making it into senior positions and being some of those leaders in the field. So we maybe here in the UK, we know that it's quite difficult to get an exact figure, but around about 20% of the AI workforce is women. Okay. And we also know that when it comes to funding of startups, and a lot of startups are AI focused at the moment, funding of startups, all women teams, the last figures I saw, got less than 2% of the venture capital funding, compared to all male teams who got something like 80% of the funding, and mixed teams got the rest. And then we know there's a gender pay gap, and we know that women don't make it into leadership positions at the same rate as men do. So all of these show us that there really is a problem with sort of women in technology and women in AI. And there are two ways, I think, to think about this. So the first one is that, you know, encouraging young women and girls into the field in the first place. And the second is sort of promoting and appreciating the women that are already there and providing career paths and bringing those up into senior positions. I think both are important.
Definitely.
Getting girls interested in science and technology. And things are changing, I think, as you start to see the impact of technology in society a bit more. I think a few more girls use a lot of apps, use a lot of social media, sort of start to understand the impact and have a little bit more interest perhaps in the computer science behind that, but still are not choosing to go on and study sort of computer science and maths and technology and engineering subjects at university. So I think encouraging women there and showing them from a young age, I think people start to make their decisions about which subjects boys and girls are good at. So really going into primary schools and early secondary school and showing them that, no, this is a valid career path for people to take, and there are women already in this field to look up to. But I do think that without the second factor, without sort of encouraging the women that are already there, so companies women do not tend to make it into leadership positions in technology in general, but also in technology at the same rate as men. And that's because various factors, but I think sort of maternity and motherhood is one important place where women of young kids really need flexibility and employers do not offer it to them in the way that they need. And so that forces a lot of women to sort of take a step back or to drop out of the workforce for a little while and really, holds them back. So flexibility, I think, is really important here. Mm-hmm. And also there is a lot of then bias in what a leader looks like and whether women can be promoted into those positions. And, when you get higher up and there are fewer and fewer women, it becomes harder and harder to sort of get promoted up. And so I think paying attention and really noticing the pay gaps that you have in your company and the way that you are treating your women leaders and the way that you are bringing up their careers, I think all of that is really important in sort of equalizing the field.
Yeah, definitely. So it's not just getting people interested in it, it's getting people coding, it's keeping them doing it.
Yeah, because I think one of the young girls and women, it's great to get them into the field. I think it's a great career, but they are not the ones with the power to change it in the long run. Mm. You need the leaders to be the ones changing the field, and so getting more women into leadership positions is really the only way.
Exactly, getting them in there so they can make the change, and flexible working. I mean, that's the hope, isn't it? I mean, with AI, lots of it, it's talking about these tools and how can they make everything easier. So we need it to really start doing that and making sure if women are leading it, then using it for how we can get people to stay in industry. Because do you build any products? Because I've seen you talking about large language models and advising people how to use it in business and risks and opportunities. Have you been involved in actually kind of building those products?
So I have. Earlier in my career, I was a sort of hands-on computer programmer, sitting down writing the code for some of these things, building the models that went into some of these products and some of the research that we have been making up the field. That was my early to mid career, and about a few years ago, I moved into more of a management position. So I started managing people. I moved a little away from hands-on coding and more onto some of the strategic and leadership thinking around AI and what we should be building. Now I work with companies who are, you know, building technology, and I'm hoping to form the bridge between what's going on in the research world and what the technology, how the technology is developing, and keeping abreast of all those and figuring out how that can be used and how that can be incorporated by companies in their work.
Okay, great. And I've seen you do a lot of sort of best practice and that kind of thing. What does best practice in AI look like? What does that mean?
Oh, I think we would need a whole other podcast for best practice in AI. I think we're still really trying to figure this out a little bit, because AI is such a new field, and we're kind of making up what the best practice is at the moment. A lot of people think that, you know, building an AI product is about building the thing and getting it out into the world, but really that's only a part of the job. We have to then look after that product and improve it and make it better over time, and that ends up being a much bigger part of the job, I think, than people realize when they start out. So putting in place ways to monitor what your product's doing, you know, that's really important to know how well it's doing in the real world, and not to put something out there which kind of works in the lab but doesn't really work in the real world. We talked about bias already, so, you know, looking out for biases, trying to mitigate them at the early stages. Even we didn't touch on another part of bias, which I think is the sorts of decisions about what you build and the products that you are building, who they're aimed at, and whether they actually fulfill, you know, the needs that people have. So choosing what you're going to build, I think, very thoughtfully is also a big part of this. And then I think a really big part of best practice is just testing properly, testing and evaluating. Like, it's really such a big part of building an AI product, is making sure that it works like you think it does, being able to justify it and being able to know when it works and also when it doesn't work, so that you can mitigate some of that and you can have a person in the loop to work with the system when it's not working, or to, you know, understand its strengths and weaknesses as well.
Yeah. So I guess that comes on to sort of like regulations and stuff. Like, is anyone regulating it, or is it very much up to each organization or whoever's deciding to build it? Is there any kind of regulation out there?
Is there regulation? Yeah. Yes. Good. Regulation, another big, like, a lot of the topics around AI are really big right now. Regulation is another one. Maybe a month ago, the EU signed into being the EU AI Act, which I think is the first real regulation of AI technology. That splits AI technology into different risk categories. So there's a sort of unacceptable risk, a high risk, a medium risk, low risk categories, and there are different obligations at different levels of that technology. So unacceptable risk technology is banned, whereas high risk technology has more obligations associated with sort of transparency and reporting with it, and then low risk technology is has a much lower bar in the regulation. So that's one example of regulation which has come into being. Other countries are thinking about regulations. And of course, there are associated regulations that are already in place. So things like the EU's GDPR and some of the health regulation that exists in Europe and the US for health devices and health data, some of the financial, you know, regulation if you're working in the financial field. So there's sector specific regulation as well, which does touch on AI technology.
And do you think, it's always people, isn't it, that are checking that and doing the regulating. Yeah. So AI has not quite taken over the world and deemed as useless yet. It's still, well, it needs us because we're building it. It's our product, isn't it? So got to keep an eye on it. And how do you use AI, like, in your personal life?
How do I use AI in my personal life? That's a good question.
I use it at work. GPT. I'm like, you're like a chef that cooks and goes home and doesn't want to do any of the cooking.
I think we have AI weaved into our everyday lives in ways that are not always noticeable. So things like, I'm a photographer as well, so I have a large library of photos. You can search photos now for, you know, objects or people, and we all go on our phone and hopefully, you know, you can see the the phone has categorized all the photos that have a picture of me or a picture of my my family in. So those things are really helpful. You can search within your image library to find a particular picture. If I know I took a picture of, I don't know, a rainbow 5 years ago, and I want to find that picture, I can search for rainbow, and it will bring up the pictures in my library. So one way that AI is used that, you know, we sort of maybe start to take for granted now, but where we have behind the scenes companies building models to understand what is in images to help us look through them. And, you know, this is really important. If we have smartphones that take lots of pictures and we start to take many, many more pictures than we used to have, and they're just sitting there on our phone, difficult to work through. So I think that's one way that, you know, people see AI in their daily lives. A lot of people, me included, use ChatGPT for various different things. It's a great sort of helper, brainstormer, and rephrase things sometimes, things like that. I know there's a lot of people in the AI world now looking at some of these new code tools. So understand tools that will help you write computer code. Proving to be quite useful, I think, if you know what you're doing and if you know how to use them, you can be much quicker at writing and brainstorming and getting your computer code written, and that can be really helpful for just day-to-day work if you're doing that. So I think there's lots of different ways. It's not like a sort of big, you know,
it's just everywhere.
Big thing that you're using, but just little things in your life where AI crops up.
Exciting. And I heard something the other day that about the sort of the picture learning thing. I don't know if you know if this is true or not, but you know when you have the capture thing, so you go on a website and you've put in your data, or it's asking for something and it checks, you know, are you a robot? And so you have to choose, you know, how many of the 6 or 8 squares or however many squares, nine squares, have got a picture of a traffic signal or a bus or a cat or a dog or something like that. Is that helping the machine learning? I mean, is that just something that was invented and we all do, or does that data get fed into AI?
Yeah, so at the beginning we talked about how to teach a machine to understand speech, and I said that you had audio with the transcription that so you know what was said in the audio to build a speech system. If you're building a system which is going to know something about images, you need the same sort of idea for images. So you need images and you need associated text or labels or something to tell you what's in the image. And so usually what we have is people who annotate those images, annotate the audio, maybe annotate the text data, whatever it is that you're looking at, with the correct answer. What's actually in that image or piece of audio, or what's in that text file. And so getting those labels for different images, people have very creative ways to do it. And so capture the, you know, click which images have a bridge in or which images have a traffic light in is one way to get some of those human verified labels for images.
Cool. And how do you see AI sort of, what are you excited about over the next, you know, like 2, 3, 4, 5 years? What do you see as the sort of big advancements, or what would you like to see happening?
So what would I like to see? I think we're at a really interesting point right now, because we had sort of ChatGPT launched 2 years ago. This was a big turning point in public awareness, they think, of AI technology and what it could and couldn't do. And now we start to see similar models that are able to deal with not just text, but images. I mean, GPT nowadays will deal with images as well if you pay for the subscription, audio, video. We're starting to see all these things come together, which I think is really interesting, because that's going to allow many different capabilities. And I think that's one of the useful things people find about ChatGPT is its ability to use image as well as text now. So this sort of multimodal models, I think, are really interesting. And we're in a world where open source technology is also building many of these things. I think open source is really interesting, because then we can build these models and lots of people can try using them. So it's very expensive to build the model in the first place, to build GPT, ChatGPT, or to build there's a model that Facebook or Meta launched called Llama. There's other models that other people have launched. These are very expensive to build. But once they're built, people can take them and run with them and try them in their own domains and own fields. So I think open source is really helping with this. And we see, you know, in scientific research, for example, researchers are coming up with really creative ways to try and use these, what we call foundation models or frontier models, to build on for their own specific domain. So I'm really interested to see what people do with them and what they find they're capable of. And we're still also trying to just figure out what these models are and aren't capable of. We've had a couple of years of experimentation and people have found some really interesting things that they can do. And I think that will continue as well. So I think we will see a big explosion of this technology used across a wide variety of domains, where you've got domain experts who know about their field working with these models that have been built by sort of open source communities or big organizations with the money to do so. So that's really exciting.
Fantastic. So there's so many opportunities out there, aren't there? So yeah, just need to embrace those. So where can our audience find out more about everything you've done? And are you available to go into primary schools? And if people want you to do that, how can they get in touch?
I have been into primary schools and I'm very happy to do so. I think LinkedIn is the best place to find me if you're interested to know. LinkedIn, and I have a website.
Okay, brilliant. We'll put links to that in the show notes, because I think you've got you do a newsletter as well, don't you, on Substack and another writing. Is because one of your other accolades that you had was one of the 100 coolest people in the UK tech world. So it's been fantastic to speak to you, Catherine. Thank you so much for coming on. You've got, there's so much more we could talk about. We'll have to get you back on and talk about best practice and regulation.
Fantastic. Really great to speak with you.
Thanks for coming.